From Relay FM, this is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of streaming media. This is episode number 68, recorded May the 3rd, 2023. I am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell, and with me, as always, our director of strategy, Julia Alexander. Hi, Julia. How are you doing?
Hey, Jason. Good. How are you?
Doing pretty good. I went to Tennessee last week. You went to Paris and London. I mean, I guess you won.
How? No, I've never been to Tennessee, and I've always wanted to go.
Memphis is great. Memphis is nice. The weather was nice, and the barbecue was fantastic.
Yeah, so you beat me there. I got to say, barbecue, I would take, and maybe I'm just an uncultured swine, as they say in London, but I would take barbecue over Parisian food.
Oh, well, okay.
All the time.
But still, Paris, probably pretty nice city.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Yeah.
Pretty nice. So we are going to cover a lot today, but I wanted to start with some follow-up, really follow-up to ourselves. But you wrote a piece in Puck that I feel like this has been one of the ongoing stories of this podcast, and it was about binge game theory, and you used two examples, Baby Reindeer and Fallout. And it goes back to, I feel like, all the debates about this, sort of like, do you do releases in a binge drop or do you release them weekly? I feel like you've had the most reasonable argument of anybody, which is some things deserve a binge drop and some things deserve to be released weekly. You know, so much, you know, you're trying to do nuance on the internet. I know that's hard, but you came up with two good examples here where there's this Baby Reindeer like viral sensation and having it be bingeable is a great idea. But then you cite a bunch of things like how that Marvel show Echo is the first one they've done as a binge drop and it did really well in week one and then vanished. And you talk about Fallout on Prime as another example of a show that probably works better strung out weekly. I feel like this is the answer is that it's not one or the other. It really is more tactical about how you release things.
Yeah, I feel like it's such a boring answer. And I said this to my Puck editors when I was pitching it. I was like, look, the answer is unfortunately going to sound very lawyer-y. It's going to be basically like, it depends.
It depends, yeah.
But it really does
depend.
It's not a hot take. And
it's the opposite of a hot take.
Right. And I think also nuance is missing from a lot of the conversation about streaming. Everything is kind of either or. And one of my an analyst I read relatively frequently, a guy named Entertainment Strategy Guy, he had a really great piece where he was talking about kind of these broadcast shows that continue to do well in streaming. So mm-hmm. like Law and Order and Family Guy. And his argument was, you know, we like to position streaming originals as being within their own camp. And this is something that I've written about as well. But at the end of the day, like, TV is TV. And so what works well on streaming typically would work well on linear. And what works well on linear would typically work well within streaming. And where it gets where I would then push back against him is where it gets differentiated is international fare. But the idea that, you know, we are not as complex creatures as we like to think that we are. And so when we look at the different viewing habits that happen with a binge versus episodic release model, what we're really talking about is taking advantage of new distribution formats that are available to us in ways that they were not before. So when we were a pure linear system, when it was you have 24 hours in a day, 7 days a week to put something on a network that people then go and find for themselves, you were much more limited in how you were going to release a title. You couldn't just do a 8-hour binge because you're expecting someone to sit on their couch for those 8 hours to tune in or catch a rerun. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. But within streaming, when you can start and stopping your own, when you can figure out ways to go about finding new programming afterwards, there is this new freedom that is afforded that we want to take advantage of. And so what I argue in this piece is that we live in, this is like a very Ben Thompson thing, but like we live in this hugely abundant era of mm-hmm. things to do, not just things to watch, but like things to do, things that are competing for your attention at any given moment. And so when you are living in this era of abundance, this era of ordinary, right, everything kind of becomes this steady heartbeat, this gentle hum, right? Like I like to call it, it's like this gentle hum of something that's consistently going on. It's this buzzing that's never ending. When you have something that is scarce by definition, it's really important to figure out how to elongate that attention that you're having. And so the two shows that I look at are Baby Reindeer, this new show from a relatively unknown, I believe he's English, he could be Scottish, but I believe he's English, writer-director. Really interesting, kind of weird, very creepy show about stalking. And so there's, I think it was 6 or 7 or 8 episodes. And so Netflix released them all at once, right? Typical Netflix format. Then you had Fallout, which is this big adaptation of this very popular game, right? Fallout, I think across all of Fallout games, you've got like 55 or 50 million copies sold. You've got actors like Walton Goggins in it, Kyle MacLachlan. You've got some pretty strong CGI taking place. And so if you talk to somebody, even just hearing those two descriptions, there is more incentive for the vast majority of people to check out Fallout than there is Baby Reindeer. Right. There's well-known actors. There is a pre-existing IP that has a lot of beloved adoration around it.
Right.
There is the genre. It's sci-fi. And so that's a really big genre. So all of these factors, when you take them into consideration, you can make an argument. This is the argument I make, that there is a stronger positioning for Fallout to be a weekly release because you have this scarce commodity and you have this attention that's built into it from an existing fan base and just more factors that lead to a higher chance. A term I like to use is a higher incentivization structure for people to check out that show. You should monetize that series and that time and attempt you're capturing in the best way possible, which is typically over 8 to 10 weeks. When you have something like Baby Reindeer, which does not have any of those factors that Fallout does, being able to release it all at once gives people the advantage of being hooked by the first episode. And instead of having to remember that, in an era of something constantly competing for their attention, they can just keep going. And so what you end up happening is that you get to the end of the show and it has this huge effect of people now completing it. Netflix's algorithm rewards completion rates, so that then pushes it up into the carousel across other people's, and then you get kind of the Squid Game effect. And something I argue in the piece is that Squid Game also benefited from this, right? Squid Game benefited from being able to finish the first episode, go into the second, especially considering it was in Korean. So outside of Korea, of course, like that might be a bit of a hurdle for a lot of people, but through social media, picking up on it, through people completing it really quick, it found its viral sensation. And I think fundamentally the argument I make when you look at all these different shows and films and you're trying to figure out what's the best way to do it, everything kind of comes back to the slate, right? So Netflix can do binge releases because Netflix constantly has something new. So if you finish a show on Netflix on a Friday, it comes out Friday, let's say you finish it Sunday, you know that by next Friday, typically Netflix is going to have something new you're interested in, whether that's an original series or newly licensed programming on their platform. This is not true on Disney Plus. This is not true on Prime Video. This is not true on Max. It's not true on Peacock, right? It is much harder for them to say, we're going to release something as a binge format and then hope that there's something next week or the week after to bring them in. If you cannot create that habitual reopening of an app and you lose that audience after their first weekend of binging, what ends up happening is that now they're going to go back to where they like to spend their time. That could be Netflix, could be Hulu, could be wherever they're going. They're going back to where they're spending their time. And so the amount that you've spent on this show, which you might see as a really strong catalyst for engagement on the platform, which you might see as a really strong brand identifier, suddenly does not have the same tangible effect as it would have had as a weekly release because it's been binged. People pick it up and then it goes away. And so you can actually see this in some of the demand data that I have at Parrot Analytics, where in its second to third week, Fallout actually saw a bit of a decline in overall demand. It peaked really high, like super high peak, and then it started to decline. This is typical also of Netflix shows. Netflix series typically have a very big peak and then come down because there's not much else to stick around for. We call that a decay rate. Versus if you look at weekly, the premiere typically does not have as high of a peak as the finale, sure, but it has a more consistent hum. And so the question then just becomes, what is more beneficial for your platform and the overall financial incentivization of the company? And what is more beneficial when you're looking at the competitive landscape? And so if you do not have the ability to have a new show every single week, but you do have the ability to have this huge IP, there's an argument that, okay, well, let's keep their attention as much as possible and get them reopening the app and creating that conversation where Netflix can really thrive on having as many shows as possible. There's a line I like to use a lot, and I'll pass it over to you, Jason, for your thoughts. I realize I have been rambling, but there's a line I like to use a lot, which is Netflix is convenience and Disney's adoration. And there's a difference in that. And neither one is necessarily better than the other. There are instances where one is better in a situation, but Netflix being convenience really responds to that habitual use case of opening an app, knowing there's something there. There's always something on. I can always find something. That is Netflix's biggest advantage, and it has served them well. Disney's biggest advantage is that it has treasure troves of franchises and characters and brands that people will check out and they will pay for, and they're willing to kind of stick around with to see what happens next. And Disney does not have the convenience of Netflix, although the Hulu integration might help with that. Netflix does not have the brand adoration of Disney. And so if you play to your strengths and acknowledge your weaknesses, that will then impact how you think about your release format.
See, this is why they you talk to your editors about this, because you're like, it's complicated, and it is. And in fact, it's frustrating in some ways, but it's true. So I can make the argument. And I mean, I have been a fan of the weekly or at least, you know, an ongoing release cycle, because it allows you to sort of think and talk about it. And then, you know, once the release is done, it's all bingeable forever there too. So I'll give you an example. Something that I watched recently on Netflix was Three Body Problem.
Yes.
And I watched it after the fact, and I watched maybe an episode every 3 or 4 days. Maybe we watched the last one on successive days, but super Jason Snell style, slow binge kind of approach. And there are several episodes of that show that, because it's the Game of Thrones guys, right? They end and it's very clearly like, this is a moment where you're like, whoa, I can't believe it. And you want to talk to people about it. But the problem is there's nobody to talk to about it, because everybody is watching it out of sync because it was a binge drop, and everybody's, they either watched it on day one, or maybe they will watch it in 2 months, and you just can't sync it up. And on that level, as a viewer who does like to have these conversations, it's frustrating. However, given the size of Netflix and Netflix's relentless pace at content releases, can you imagine a world where everything on Netflix released weekly? The problem is there would be so much chaos, so much traffic, because instead, like, Netflix just releasing everything in a binge drop has it almost impossible to keep track of schedule of content. They make so much stuff. And if every single one of those is rolling out over 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever, it is that much more confusing. And I think that it would get lost. I think in the end, it would get lost, that you almost need the big binge drop and that number in week one to get noticed on Netflix. And that is not an effect. So, like, could there have been better conversations about Three Body Problem if it had been stretched out over 8 weeks? Yes. Is that something that makes sense for Netflix? No. I think my argument would be no. I think if I'm Netflix, I do a binge drop, even though I don't like them. That's what Netflix, it's like the nature of Netflix. It is that. And they would need to cut way back on their content rollout for it to make sense. Whereas for almost every other streamer, I feel like it does make sense. Because as you said, you're really trying to kind of keep it rolling. And also, if you're not on Netflix, you're on Disney Plus, you actually have an opportunity to get people to notice on week two or week three to keep the conversation going, which will feed more people in. Whereas on Netflix, realistically, if it doesn't catch fire in week one, it's kind of over, because it's gone. Mm-hmm. It's off enough. You will have to go look for it in the Netflix interface to see it. And I think that that's just, does that make sense? Does that track with you? That's sort of like, yeah. It's not just a show thing. It's a Netflix thing.
Yeah. No, that's exactly it. I agree with you 100%. I think that's what I was trying to get to with the platform economics. It really depends on what's going on with the specific platforms and their own trained audience incentivization structure that they create. And so if we think about Netflix, like I'll give you an example. We look at Nielsen top 10s, right, every week. And if you break it down by platform, which this journalist who goes by TV Grim Reaper, I love all these anonymous guys, by the way, they have great names, like, yeah. TV Grim Reaper, Entertainment Strategy Guy, just great names. So TV Grim Reaper, he has a lovely Nielsen source who kind of feeds him these weekly breakdowns, top 10 breakdowns across each platform. And then he posts them on Twitter for all of us to enjoy, which I appreciate. And he posted this one, and it was like the week of Three Body Problem. It had been the second week of Three Body Problem. And so that was still performing really well, but it had not been their new show. Like, it was the second week of the show. And if you looked at the top 10 on Netflix, if I remember correctly, because I don't have the article in front of me, I think it was like there was no show that went under 250 million minutes viewed. And number 10 on that list was Stranger Things. So people were actually, you know, still engaging with that series. And then if you looked at Prime Video, there was half of the shows fell under 100 million minutes, right? So they're not even competing with the engagement levels on Netflix. But more importantly, if you look at the number of new titles, which I defined by 2 to 3 weeks of release, on Netflix, of those top 10, 8 were new. And on Amazon, of those top 10, 2 were new. Mm-hmm. And so that is not necessarily an issue with, oh, Amazon has fewer shows or whatever it might be, although that's certainly a case. It's that Netflix has this consistent level of new series coming out, again, both new and acquired, meaning licensing, that are just keeping these audiences who are coming back for that convenience engaged. And so that's what they expect out of it. And I don't think it's necessarily fair to think most of the other streamers can compete. Now, some will definitely try, right? So like HBO, when HBO is HBO Max, combined with the Discovery option to kind of create that more four quadrant. Four quadrant, again, for listeners, is old, young, male, female. So really creating that four quadrant space. You've got Disney again with Hulu looking to kind of create that four quadrant space. And so they're definitely trying to compete with that convenient factor of Netflix. But if you look at where their strengths still lie, you know, HBO owns Sunday, and that's still one of the largest drivers of engagement on Max. You know, Disney Plus has Lucasfilm, which is Star Wars and Marvel, and that's still its strongest engagement. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think if you actually look at some of their original titles based on Nielsen, again, that come from TV Grim Reaper, none of their originals outside of the Marvel and Star Wars are really performing super well. And so there's that concern of, okay, you have this new show that is going to perform well, right? It could be a Loki or it could be a Fallout, which is great. And you have that audience, but then your audiences are not necessarily engaging with the rest of your catalog, including a new series, versus on Netflix, they are.
Right.
So for Netflix, the incentivization structure is, okay, how do we compete with the brands that we don't necessarily own? We're going to have something new. So that way people, when they're finished engaging, will watch something else. There was a really interesting study from Roku that was published, I think 2 years ago, might have been last year, 2 years ago. And it showed that binge viewers actually increased, it was like 70% of binge viewers then like searched for another title within the next week, right, on that same platform, compared to 46% of viewers who were looking at weekly. And so if you just consider that, you can see that incentivization structure for Netflix, which is they watch something, they finish it, then there's a higher likelihood that they will search for something else on that platform and they kind of stick there. And as any of us who have our favorite apps where we spend our time, my really crude way of thinking about your favorite app is what you open when you're on the toilet, right? That is like your go-to app. It is what you have time and you look at it. And that's crude, but I think it's a good way of summarizing human behavior. And so when you think about that moment, so that's kind of Netflix, right? This idea of, okay, we're going to keep them here. We're going to keep them opening it. And even if it's binge, we know that this type of activity is actually really helping with our platform economic structure. But if you look at the rest of them, it actually hurts to release as binge because they don't have the type of habitual behavior, nor do they necessarily have the level of engagement that means that even if they brought in other licensed programming or if they had a new series, they're not capturing the audience the same way that Netflix is. And so I think if I was consulting with a lot of these companies, some of them I do, some of them I don't, with my job at Parrot, it's this question of you're not trying to win the week, although you are, right? So again, like convoluted, but you're not trying to win the week, although you are. You're not trying to win the month, although you are. You're really trying to win like that 6 to 12 month space of slate because you need to build an activity. The people have more options than ever to do something. You need to capture their attention and then turn that slice of attention that you capture into a repetitive motion at half the marketing cost, right? So you don't want to be spending to recapture that attention. There's a phrase, it's not really a phrase, but there's an thesis that every marketing ploy for a show is basically just efforts to resubscribe the same customer. And so your customer acquisition costs are basically your marketing costs and they shoot through the roof. So if you don't have marketing costs, your customer acquisition potential goes down. And you don't want to be spending over and over and over again on the same customer and acquiring the same customer, or reacquiring the same customer. You don't want to be spending that much money. And so figuring out how to best use these release formats, now that there is actual options to like figure out how to do it, is a great way. And I'll end on this. I noted in the Puck piece that I think Amazon specifically released Fallout all at once because it was just ahead of earnings, just ahead of the upfront. So Amazon's doing its first upfront, which is the biggest advertising conference in New York. And I think they wanted something big. I think they wanted to showcase that they could be bigger than Netflix in terms of the audience that they have on the ad platform, and that they could reach Netflix numbers. And what's one way to do that? You've released a show that's that is probably going to be really popular all at once because the numbers are going to be huge. And so I think there was a specific reason within Fallout, but I do think it's a good example of looking at like if you look at Disney, they released Echo, which was their Daredevil spinoff show,
right,
all at once, right? And I've heard people say, like critics, that Disney was trying to bury it. I don't think that was true. I think Disney was experimenting with the format and seeing like, does this work out better for us? And if you look at it, Echo did 12.2 million views in its first week, which puts it on par with Loki's second season in terms of that premiere, which is pretty strong. It's a good premiere. But then whereas Loki continued to make the Nielsen charts for the next 5 weeks, Echo disappeared. And so this question of, okay, well, what you're spending on it and what this is trying to do for you, and with the lack of supply you have, is this the best way of going about it,
right,
versus with Netflix? The supply is their biggest advantage.
Yeah. Endless supply, essentially.
Exactly.
And it takes a difference. Yeah, you're right. It's also what effect you want. So you can drop Fallout in a binge and you're going to get a big boost. But it might not be as word of mouth and as part of the zeitgeist. But right, if what you're trying to do is get a good number, that's one way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
What does that leave us with? A letter. I have one letter for us to talk about. And then we will depart. This is from Jeremy. Jeremy says, since I've had the option, I paid to remove ads from my streaming service subscriptions. Increasingly, it's clear I'm a less valuable customer than one on an ad-supported plan. But while I don't provide as much value in dollars, don't I and my fellow ad haters represent more engaged viewers? Aren't we more likely to watch and rewatch and binge and help shows go viral? What do you think? Is that insight or vanity? Am I fooling myself?
What do you think?
First off, I think that the raising of prices shows that you are, what they want you to do is comparably valuable, right? They want you to be, right now they're making more from ads plus subscription than they are from just subscription. So what they want is for that to get balanced out. At that point, I don't know, I was hoping you might have some data. Do we know profile-wise, behavior-wise, the difference in behavior between people who are on ad plans and people who are not in terms of engagement? Because I honestly don't know. And I thought maybe Parrot, I don't know if Parrot's done any research on that, but that would be my question.
We haven't done any research on it. What some of the third party data suggests is that ad supported subscribers tend to be a little bit lower income. They tend to be less sticky than the ad-free subscribers, who tend to be stickier, tend to be more habitual users of the app. But that said, I don't necessarily think, Jeremy, that you are less valuable. And I'm sure that the companies appreciate all of your dollars that you spend month after month. I think what they need to showcase right now is that the advertising tier can work. And so they've proven, especially companies like Netflix, they've proven that they can get people on ad-free tiers. Like, that's been true since 2013. And what they cannot prove as much is that there is a large enough audience willing to spend time on the ad-supported tier and to continue showing up month after month. And so if I'm Netflix, I'm really focusing on ensuring that that audience feels like they're getting a really premium experience, even at a lower cost, and even with ads. And so because I'm trying to sell that tier still, I don't necessarily need to sell the ad-free tier, nor do I necessarily need to sell people on the ad-free tier, especially those right, who have shown decreased churn interest. So they're less likely to cancel.
Especially when we talk about Netflix, and they are just so data-driven. I would say, but I think it's true for all, this is not a simple metric, or at least it doesn't have to be a simple metric, value of a subscriber, right? Like, Are ad people more likely to churn or less likely to churn, right? Than not ad people? Engagement is part of it. You could base it entirely based on the total amount of revenue, the ARPU for each user, but I bet that's not it. I bet that's not just it, right? You do perhaps say, yeah, but these guys churn less. They stay longer. They're more loyal. They watch more. They're more engaged. They follow to the end more. And whichever group that is, actually, you would weight that a little bit in your calculation. Because I don't think in the end, most of these services are just looking at the ARPU and saying, let's square up the ARPU. It's not that simple. I would say you could do it that way, but I would say you're leaving probably money and on the table by doing that, because what you kind of want to do is find, like, how do you get the, if one group is more valuable than the other in the long term, you can afford to charge them less and keep more of them around because they're going to be valuable in the long term. If they're not, then don't worry about it. But I'm not 100% convinced that ad haters are more engaged. I mean, you have to not, if people don't pay attention during ads and they don't want to watch the ads, that's true. But like, I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think that might be an assumption. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're still figuring it out. We're in the infancy of the ad supported tier. So,
right. But they want to think about global value. So, what I would say to Jeremy is, if it is true that you're more engaged and maybe you churn less, then yeah, you're getting credit for that. But in the end, the credit for that is that they're not raising your rate as high as they could have. That's the credit you get. But, you know, there's a limit to that, because it's very hard to look and say, okay, I have two subscribers here, one on my ad plan and one on my ad free plan. And I make $10 from the one on my ad plan and I make $7 on the ad free plan. Like, you can't do that. You know, your choices there are to make everybody watch ads or to raise the ad free plan level so that you're not, you know, so that you're making as much money from them in the long run, at least.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just had this happen where I saw that Peacock is raising the cost of their premium plan, which I'm on. And I thought, I don't know. Like, I'm that may be the first to go where I'm like, if I need to see something on Peacock, I'll watch it with ads. Most of what I watch is sports anyway, which has ads in it anyway.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the danger. As you raise it, you're going to get some churn.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you have a question for us, visit downstreamfeedback.com. Love to your mothers. We love hearing from you. We'll be back in 2 weeks. If you are not a Downstream Plus subscriber, you missed us talking about Sports Corner. We talked about Diamond v. Comcast and NBA on NBC versus TNT, and about the future of Paramount, which was very messy and very dramatic. So most of the show is available just for supporters. If you would like to support us, go to downstream.plus. You'll get full versions of every episode, access to the Relay FM Discord, which is awesome, bonus shows from Relay FM, and much more. You can find Director of Strategy Julia at parrotanalytics.com and puck.news. You can find me at sixcolors.com, and I appear on many other podcasts at Relay FM and theincomparable.com. Until next time, Julia, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.